afternoon and welcome to today's broadcast of Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. Today's day is March 16th, 2015. On this Monday afternoon, a program that I have been have marked on my calendar for the past couple of days and looking forward to, as we will have a guest coming on joining us during the second hour, and that is Miss Angela Chan. She is an attorney by law, senior staff attorney at the Asian Americans Advancing Justice and Asian Law Caucus. And in case you didn't see this come across your social media feed, she authored an article dealing directly with the 13th Amendment, and no beating around the bush, no calling it something other than what it really is. But the title of this article that was published on the Huffington Post was America Never Abolished Slavery, something that we have often said on this network for the past 3 years. And, you know, it is a pleasure to welcome in someone to that. Let's call it the abolitionist club. Now, I don't know if Ms. Chan considers herself an abolitionist, but she's using abolitionist language. All right. And she's calling for a stop to it. So we're certainly looking forward to speaking to her during the second hour of the broadcast. The first hour, we will spend it. We'll just do open forums. The conference line is open if you have some news to report. But let the news be serious. We don't care about, you know, what celebrity is dating another celebrity or getting all up in people's business like that. You know, something, we want a war report. That's what we want on this program. We want to inform people about what's going on the battlefield. Because, in fact, you know, there is war being waged. And as we will focus on during the second hour, slavery is also being practiced. And all the problems that we see in American society today certainly can be linked in the context of slavery and people not being viewed as American citizens, despite, you know, how many flag waving and people that have black people or other non-white people who hold political office. None of that matters. You know, the only thing that matters is the facts. So, but I do want to address on the propaganda war front. I do want to address some propaganda, what I call vicious lies. I certainly could not find any evidence to support some reports that have been circulating on social media. Now, I've known about it for the past, let's say, 48 hours. I first saw it. Someone shared it on Facebook, and so it showed up in my news feed. So I looked at it. I investigated it. I determined that this was nothing but slanderous lies against the mother of Michael Brown. I believe her name is Leslie McSpadden. Just vicious lies, saying that she had posted comments to Facebook celebrating the reported shooting of two cops in Ferguson. And I took a screenshot of the evidence that they was presenting, which was a blurry picture, a JPEG file to be exact, of a supposed screenshot. And it was all blurred out, and there's just no excuse for that. Yeah. What are you trying to hide? And so anybody can make up a social media profile and then make a comment on something, or you could comment on something, or take a screenshot of Facebook and copy and paste out some comments that you made. It's easy to do, people. It's very easy. It's a lot of fraud that's going on out there. And so I've known about it for the last 48 hours. But I wasn't going to contribute to, helping to push these vicious lies on the, about Michael Brown's mother. And also they are trying to link it, of course, to the protesters. This is all a smear campaign. Again, this is warfare that is being waged, and propaganda, has always been a major part. So all of this anti-blackness, code words like thugs, referring to Michael Brown. And, you know, right now it's just circulating on what you might describe as your typical right wing blogs. Some of them, you know, they look professionally done, like, you know, news sites. And they make it look like, you know, this is an actual news report. But in fact, if they did their investigation, they would find that they couldn't find a second source other than the blurry picture, which was uploaded to a website called The Young Cons. And so it seems to me that The Young Cons is running a con game. And this is just all part of warfare when you wage in war on people. You know, right now they're talking about the shootings. Of course, they have said that they have made an arrest, but we're getting conflicting statements from officials, whether that's Bob McCullough, the prosecutor, St. Louis prosecutor. What's the other guy named? St. Louis County Police Chief. I think his name is John Belmar, if I'm not mistaken. And we covered some of that last week. You know, the for him to come out right within hours of these cops allegedly being shot, here he is saying that they were deliberately targeted. This is the police chief who's supposed to oversee all investigations and things, and he's coming out and making statements like that when there's no way in that amount of time could he determine. And it just flies in the face of the videos that were recorded and uploaded, and flies in the face of people who were out there saying that bullets were whizzing by their head and they could have been shot as well. And now we have the same officials trying to link the alleged shooter, this young black male, and saying he was a protester. Or he was a protester. So it's all a part of undermining the Black Lives Matter movement, which the young people have named it. But now I'm starting to see more and more non-white people share this same propaganda. And so, again, you know, I talk about racism and the system of racism and white supremacy. And I have this theory that if people, non-white, white, whatever classification, decided that they were not going to participate in upholding the system by being little cogs in the machine, that the whole system would collapse. The whole system would collapse. So when we participate in stuff that's designed to undermine our war efforts, and those war efforts, that objective, I would say, is to, in a codified manner, say, is to establish a system based on justice. So when we participate in sharing, you know, things that haven't been fleshed out, if you will, if they're not coming from a black source, number one, always consider the source. And so I have, of course, you know, use the tool called Google, and there are other search engines, not endorsing, you know, one over the other, but it is just so easy. And some of the basic tenets of journalism that I think if you're going to read things on the internet, that you should also be aware of those tenets or those rules when you're writing, that you have to have more than one source to at least establish it or present it as a fact. And they've done none of this. They've done none of this. Haven't linked to an active Facebook profile. They say that one was deleted, but I was able to pull up one bearing her name. I don't know if it was her or not. Somebody could have created it, posted whatever their legend was posted, and then deleted it. Or perhaps the account was hacked and somebody made those comments. And so now it has, the profile has been disabled because it was hacked. See, when none of these things, none of these different scenarios or likelihoods, you know, just logical things or alternatives, and people just latch on and present something as fact, they're using that as a weapon of warfare, a propaganda spear. So I couldn't find anything to support that Ms. McSpadden was quote unquote celebrating the reported shooting of two cops in Ferguson, which I also learned today. And this kind of underscores something that came out in the Department of Justice report, is that it's not just Ferguson. This was not just Ferguson, but it was all the little towns and stuff around there, because now it's coming out that two of those police officers who were allegedly shot, I haven't seen them in a press conference or anything like that, so I can only go off of news reports and say that it's been alleged that two cops were shot, but they weren't even Ferguson. They weren't even employed by the city of Ferguson through the Ferguson Police Department. They were from what the chief was saying today, or in the past 24 hours, is that they were from other towns. Now, isn't that what the Department of Justice said in its report? That it wasn't just Ferguson practicing racism, white supremacy against the black citizens or residents, rather, because they're not being treated as citizens, but the black residents were being targeted in a money-making scheme. Not only did they violate constitutional rights, but they violated federal statutes. Although I don't believe, I'm still sorting through the report, but I'm going off of memory right now. They said federal statutes violations. You know, federal, yeah, there were some violations of federal statute. That's federal law. But they don't name, in summary, at least they don't. They don't name what federal statutes were violated. And one of the theories that I've been putting out there is that RICO Act violations, because of the monetary nature of the crime with all the other elements that just exacerbated, you know, the racism and racist practice and patterns is one element. But in terms of federal law, RICO Act, because it was to generate revenue. There was a report that was put out on CNN. And I want to play that report. Now, I don't mean to jump off on a tangent, but really, I just wanted to tell people about, you know, this stuff that's being pushed out there about Ms. McSpadden. It's not true. And so don't even entertain it. Don't share it. Don't help it, you know, get more and more views, because there are a lot of people, millions of people, who will read straight up propaganda, straight up vicious lies about people, and then, you know, you helping to spread that. I'm a victim of it myself. Tim Wise victimized me in that manner just yesterday. Here I'm getting somebody's liking a tweet where Tim Wise accuses me of misquoting him. And I don't care to revisit all of that, but yeah, people accepting things to be true without any investigation, and we can't do that. But the investigation, again, has been done. And the chief was saying the other day, again, that those weren't Ferguson cops who allegedly were shot. They were from other departments. So this is bigger than just Ferguson. This is way bigger than just Ferguson. So let me just pull up a clip that CNN did a segment, and they were just talking about the RICO Act. They never used the words RICO Act, but they called it Ferguson Policing for Profit. But of course, we have to include all those little cities, all the other little departments that I'm wondering if these two cops who were allegedly shot, I mean, they were operating outside of their jurisdiction. What did they do? Just volunteer to come over here? You don't even have the authority. And, you know, I don't know all the technicalities and things of that nature, but, you know, there are jurisdictional issues or questions there. And so I'm sure there is a paper trail that show these other little towns within St. Louis County that all of these cops, and I will even say the St. Louis Police Department, were policing for profit, targeting black people. It's much bigger than Ferguson. It's the county. And again, those two cops that allegedly got shot, and the police chief, John Belmar, saying that they weren't Ferguson cops, and They were from other departments, but they didn't work for. See, that's just a whole nother avenue to go down, another rabbit hole. But it's evidence. But here's something CNN said.
$3.1 million of projected income from public citations this year. It's the growth of that that is so remarkable. $1.38 million back in 2010. Now that anticipated $3.1 million. That's more than double, almost triple in 5 years, showing you the city is relying more and more on these fines and fees. What's also very interesting about it is where those fines and fees are coming from. They're coming out of the pockets of the people stopped by police. In some cases, police were competing with each other to see how many tickets they could give in a single traffic stop or a single stop. Total arrests, 93% of total arrests were African Americans. 88%, this is all from the Department of Justice report, 88% of cases involving a use of police force, African Americans. Vehicle stops, 85% African Americans. So that's why so many people are saying this looks like a city policing for profit and basically funding the government to a very big degree, African Americans who live in Ferguson.
So not only are these people being taxed, paying property tax, paying water tax, whatever fees all associated with life and owning property or leasing property, really, because nobody owns anything. Try not paying your taxes and see how long you will be in possession of that property. So don't want to help promote any falsehoods in that aspect. But these people not only pay taxes, they pay probably the majority of the taxes. But also the city found another revenue stream by just ticketing these people, stopping and frisking. Something wasn't mentioned, walking while black. The manner and the way, the manner and way the person was walking down the street, that gave them probable cause to stop somebody. And again, you know, here it is, all of this profit. And let's also look at the timeline. Who came into power in 2010? I think John Belmar might have became the police chief of St. Louis County in 2010. Don't quote me on that. Somebody can look it up if they so choose. But I'm willing to bet you that all the people that were named in the Department of Justice report, as well as, you know, the people who have not quit their jobs or been forced to quit, like the mayor, Mr. Knowles, I bet you that there was a convergence of all of these people coming into office. The stars lined up where you had all these people in key positions and places on the county level, on the municipal level. This is what I'm saying. These people should be on criminal conspiracy charges right now. Should have been arrested. Not, you know, cleaning out their desk, but perp walked out of their the scenes of the crimes, which was the police departments, which were the offices. So again, until that happens, you could just say that we live in a lawless country, that the federal government is willing to allow all of this criminality and just lightly slap these people on the wrist and just simply make them quit their jobs and not prosecute them for these crimes. Why? Because they're black? Is that what you're going to tell me? I mean, if this was like, let's say, a reverse situation, if this was my county is anywhere from 75% to 80% white, going by, I think, the 2010 census. And I would say that that's accurate. Just, you know, eyeballing it, I would say that's accurate. Now, what is happening to the black people in Ferguson? What's happening to the white people here in this county that I live in? Do you think that they would allow to go on? Huh? Nobody would even think about doing it, because most of the people in power in this county are white, and therefore the majority of the population is white, and they're not willing to do people that look like them like that. See what I'm saying? But then when you got a predominant non-white population, but the key people in power are white, this is what happens when those people in power are racist white supremacists. There's no other logical definition for this. These are actually international criminals, if we want to apply international law. And I know there's a segment, especially among the right-wing people that produce these blogs slandering the name of victims' mothers and going on to Wikipedia to change, you know, articles about victims of police terrorism. Give me just a second. I think we got a call coming in. All right, no. Let me make sure I have the phone lines open so that when our guest joins us, she won't have any problem getting through. So again, going back to this, if this was the situations were reversed, the color lines were, you know, switched, I just think these people would be up on criminal charges. I don't think they would be allowed to just quit their jobs and even retire and draw a pension. No, I think these people would have been arrested for perpetrating such a crime against American citizens. I think the federal government, everybody, there will be uniformity in the media, uniformity in on the political aisles, everybody would come together. It will be a bipartisan issue. These people must face the full weight of the law. They must be put on trial, and if they are determined guilty, because just think of the magnitude. If you charge how many, they could have 19,000 individual charges. Thousands of individual charges for every individual that was victimized. They would probably be looking at something like 1 million years. You know what I'm saying? So I'm sure, you know, people will try to deny what I'm saying. But if you just look at the facts, I'm not being emotional about this. I'm not being logical. I mean, I'm being illogical. Excuse me. And then for us to know that this is going on all over the country. And I can't say for certain, because I haven't pulled the data, but in my county that's 80% white, there I do not hear a lot of black people in this county, my family, my relatives, complaining about being, you know, stopped while driving black or walking black. And, you know, so I'm just offering that. So, you know, for what it is, I couldn't imagine experiencing this kind of treatment on a daily basis. If I just walk out to my mailbox and, you know, police officer is coming down the road and he, cause I'm black, he gonna stop and ask me questions. If I don't want to talk to him and I want to walk away from him, then, oh, I'm what? Resisting arrest. But I haven't even been accused or charged. I'm exercising my constitutional right to. I could imagine dealing with that on a daily basis. These people in Ferguson and other counties all over the country, cities, counties all over the country, by their own statistical data, the grassroots people out there have done the work already, who are suffering under these conditions. Then people want to talk about how can the people described in this report save any kind of money, you know, invest in anything constructive when their money is being taken away from them. They're losing jobs behind it and you know, getting fired because, you know, you got caught up in the, multiple cities were, you know, transferring prisoners from jail to jail to jail. So that's a human trafficking ring right there. How can people lift themselves up by their bootstraps? It's impossible. At least that's what the wealthiest people in the United States seem to say, or those people that speak for them, their proxies, their lobbyists, PACs and whatnot. They say just paying, you know, the regular, whatever the federal income tax is or wage tax is, they don't want to pay what the majority of the people pay. They say that's stealing from them. That the United States government is robbing them. And that if other people just work hard and, you know, stay out of trouble, then they too can be quote unquote successful. Now imagine if in a community where Bill Gates lived and the police who patrol, which probably that community probably has its own private security. All these rich folks didn't come together. Yeah, they can afford a budget. But imagine if police were just stopping rich people in their neighborhoods in the manner for which they was walking that poodle down the street. I didn't like the way you was walking that poodle. That poodle looked like it might have been wobbling a little bit. So have you been giving this poodle drugs? I'm gonna have to stop you. Now I'm gonna have to, you know, don't, you know, quote the constitutional rights to me. No, I'm gonna jack you up and throw you on this car, frisk you, and yeah. See how many tickets I can write. And each one of those tickets, let's say, you know, is proportionate to these rich, wealthy people's income. And let's say each ticket, it cost them $10,000. You know, you got to come down here and pay, first of all, $50,000 bill. Got to come up with at least 10% of that, but we know you got it. So you just pay that $50,000. Then you can hire your attorneys and whatnot. And, you know, or you just come in and dispute this fine. But we find you guilty and the judge is on, you know, he's part of this scheme to raise money. He's going to find you guilty. So, I mean, yeah, you can hire who you want to hire. Yeah, he's going to uphold this fine. So $10,000 right there. Bam. Manner in the way that you was walking that poodle down the street. Would these people tolerate that? No, they wouldn't tolerate that. They would go hire mercenaries to fight the police. That's why they got their own private security. They don't have to deal with that. Then, you know, there is a actual servant master relationship. I mean, cause we're told that police are supposed to be what they call the, public servants. And I don't like, you know, describing people as masters of another people, but let's just say, you know, the people are their employers, but you're not acting, you know, do you treat your other employers like this? I'm the one that's paying. See, nah. I tell you, man, it is rough out here. It's really rough out here. And if you're paying attention, you know, you should be trying to formulate strategies to end all of this. I mean, it's one thing for us to talk about it, and I know there are plenty of people, probably thousands. It might be tens of thousands. It could be millions of people working together to end racism, white supremacy. So I don't want to say nobody's doing nothing. Because, again, at the billion, however many billion people it is on this planet, and the majority of them being non-white people, if they just decided one day that I'm not going to participate in this system, the whole system would collapse. It really boils down to being that simple. So I never want to say that there is nobody out there, but, you know, this kind of information, this intel, if you will, you know, it can certainly help us in the propaganda warfare that's being waged on the internet. Certainly it can help us, but also on a community level, it can help us. If you see that a community over here was able to successfully take control of their local government and be in charge, like I heard about Jackson, Mississippi. What is the late mayor's name? Chokwe Lumumba, who recently passed away. I heard from some other, some activists during the course of a conversation that that is the first city in the United States to implement international law. It's a human rights city. That city observes the human rights and observes things like the CERT treaty that the United States actually signed but refuses to implement because, you know, particularly among the right wing, but there are those on the so-called left as well that say that, well, we don't want the UN or any other international bodies interfering in our business. We don't want to subject any of our quote unquote citizens to their laws. And so therefore, you know, they ignore it. But they could sign a treaty and say that they, you know, which means that you believe in the principles of, you know, the conference to eliminate racial discrimination and follow the guidelines. But then, you know, the ambassador or whoever signed that flies back home and, hey, it never happened. So Jackson, I heard, is the first city to where they have implemented, you know, some of the international laws that are embodied by this treaty. So if you can see something like that, an example, that's, you know, I would say that that's constructive. Now, in terms of them implementing it, the city could, if the wrong people are there in power, they could choose to even ignore their local laws and not pay attention to human rights. You know, continue to use solitary confinement, police brutality, terrorism, and all of that, and no prosecutions against those who violate people's human rights. No criminal prosecutions whatsoever for these people. So we have to, I guess, say, get more aggressive, I guess, in fighting on all fronts, whatever, you know, you determine a front to be in this war and you think you're good at it, then do it. But the most simple thing we could do is not participate, not help, people practice racism and white supremacy against others as much as you can. If you see something, say something. Of course, you had to, you know, really think that out, in terms of if it could cost you your job and things like that, and if you're willing to make that sacrifice. Certainly, many thousands upon thousands and unheard of millions have decided not to participate just because a lot of people were doing it. They was like, no, I'm not going to participate. And I'm going to do what I think will be in the interest and furtherance of justice, no matter what the repercussions. Man, if that became the majority of people, then all the evils, when I came on the air, we could just play music all day long and celebrate. Celebrate what a wonderful world we live in. Yes. Wouldn't have to come on and get these war reports day after day after day, tell you about casualties and wow. Anyway, we're going to take a break coming up. Once again, we will be speaking to Ms. Angela Chan. She is the policy director and senior staff attorney at the Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. She recently authored an article dealing with the 13th Amendment, which is titled America Never Abolished Slavery. And again, I think The Huffington Post might be the biggest name, what could be considered mainstream publication in dealing with news and you know, whatnot, to actually publish such a piece that's just straight out. I mean, there's no beating around the bush. When you read that title, it's straight forth. It's relaying a fact to you, and it's up to you to, you know, investigate further. I was just thinking today, one of the questions, and I hope I don't forget to ask Ms. Chan, One of the questions I had will have for her is, how many of these mainstream outlets contacted you? Because look, this article was shared by tens of thousands of people on social media. I haven't checked the latest numbers, but you know, when I looked at it earlier, just recalling from memory, tens of thousands of people, you know, shared this article. I would say it went viral. You know, it didn't go like, you know, 2 million views of, you know, somebody doing something foolish. You know how those attract, you know, a lot of views and they go viral, but a significant number of people actually read this article that said America never abolished slavery. So did I would think that MSNBC, NBC, CNN, you know, that we will be seeing Miss Chan on there for a segment on America never abolished slavery. I don't think they do news on the History Channel, but I mean, here we have another attorney. We have the Minnesota Attorney of the Year, Miss Nakia Levy Pounds, a law school professor. She has been on this station on the program New Abolitionist Radio, I think several times. And she will tell whoever will listen that the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. I mean, there are at least, if I went back through the archives, and not just on this station, but other stations, I remember calling into the context of white supremacy to ask an attorney about the 13th Amendment and whether or not slavery was abolished. She was pretty, you know, a person of note in her field of law and, you know, highly respected and whatnot. What they call, you know, impeccable credentials, if you pay attention to those sort of things in the system. But she also said, yeah, the United States is practicing slavery. You would think this would be headline news on every headlines as if, you know, a World War III had broke out. But no, there has been considerable media silence. So the next logical question to ask would be, why? Why do you think we haven't seen Miss Chan being interviewed on You Pick a Network talking about her fact-based article, which she also co-authored, I should throw in there, not one person, but three people worked on this article. And they all three came to the conclusion, one of them being a senior staff attorney and policy director, that's Miss Chan, came to the same conclusion that America never abolished slavery. And it was published again on the Huffington Post. That's not that the Huffington Post doesn't have the history of a New York Times or, you know, Time magazine or any of the alphabet networks like ABC, CBS, NBC, whatnot. And now we have the cable spinoffs of those networks. But I have, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe Miss Chan will correct me and let me know, if, you know, pick a television personality that hosts a political social rate, television program. If they invited her to, you know, come on the program. If the producers invited her to speak on this, this is like, again, I mean, it's not shocking to people who consider themselves abolitionists. This is not shocking. This is more of, you know, confirmation, thankfulness that, you know, to get a headline that declares this undeniable truth that slavery was never abolished. But, you know, again, tens of thousands of people, that's a lot of people, but then again, it's not. Because Mrs. Chan hasn't, in my opinion, I'm making an assumption again, we should make those, but I would think, you know, at least Politics Nation, y'all know who hosts Politics Nation, would have invited her on to talk about, what do you mean that the United States and the states are practicing slavery? What do you mean? We just had 150th anniversary of whatever, during Black History Month, 50 years after Selma, and you mean tell me that slavery is in fact still legal? I mean, pick any non-white host. Well, that go to show, since you haven't seen that, that go to show you is they're not in control of their program. They probably seen the article. They know about the article. They probably already knew this truth, but they don't get to decide who comes on their programs. Producers do. Producers, and then there's another level above them, executive directors and, you know, a whole level. A whole chain of command. So again, if you can answer that question, what logical reason could there be that websites, blogs, and, you know, even establishment mainstream sites aren't publishing this headline or even writing their own articles, either challenging the facts that Mrs. Chan and the others who co-authored the article, America Never Abolished Slavery, they could be challenging their facts and say, hey, they got it wrong and here's why that's wrong. Or they could be saying, yeah, and here's some additional information that supports America Never Abolished Slavery. We're not even seeing that. I'm not one to just throw out conspiracy theories and whatnot, but I've been paying attention to this particular subject for a very long time. But look, we're going to take a break. I will check the phone lines. If you do have a question that you want to ask Ms. Chan, she's only going to be able to be with us for about 30 minutes. I already got my list of questions. So get your phone calls in early to the conference line, 530-881-1400. The participant code is 549032 #. Then once you are in, hit *6 in the number 1. So don't wait, you know, and try to be, you know, quick and concise so that we can allow Mrs. Chan the opportunity to speak the most, you know, about this issue of slavery and what I call also human trafficking going on in the United States. We're going to listen to some message music, and then we'll come back. Again, I'll check the phone lines and talk about some more news, some things. There was this cop man who said that Black people should be hunted down like dogs and killed. Yeah, I mean, seriously, if I'm remembering correctly, so we'll talk about it on the other side.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
I'm Tanya Free. Issues of race relations continue to dominate our lives. Tensions are high after the shooting of 2 police officers outside the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department during demonstrations demanding more changes after the resignation of the police chief, including the disbanding of the entire police department and the resignation of the mayor. Now there are those that are blaming the demonstration and peaceful protesters for the shooting. And days after the University of Oklahoma ousted Sigma Alpha Epsilon from its campus following a viral video of members singing a racist chant, some in the media have found a way to blame the hip-hop community and the culture for a group of young white kids singing about excluding and murdering Black kids. You can't make this stuff up. What's your take? Let's talk about it this Wednesday on the Tanya Free and Friends Talk Show and 24/7 at TanyaFree.com. Until next time, be free and remember to live life with a purpose.
The Tanya Free and Friends Talk Show, your destination for the best in social and political straight talk. Wednesdays at 2 p.m., streaming live on TanyaFree.com and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 2 p.m.
They use force on inmates. They beat up inmates. They planted evidence or weapons in cells.
If an inmate was beaten up, presumably if he made a complaint, there had to be some sort of investigation.
It would be squashed at the management level. It wouldn't go any farther than that. it wouldn't go any farther than probably the supervisor of that yard.
Donald Boddicker is now in hiding. We had to agree his lawyer came to the interview, and we couldn't say where we met them.
Ever since I broke the code of silence, I've lost everything. I've lost friends that I had associated with the Department of Corrections. I've lost some of my family members. I've lost everything. I lost my career. I lost financially. It was devastating. I'm on the move all the time.
Why?
Because I fear for my life, for my life, for my life, for my life.
Black Talk Radio News, Scotty Reed in on this microphone. Now, everybody, again, if I have time after we speak with our scheduled guest, Ms. Angela Chan, I want to revisit some of the things involving this alleged shooting that happened to these two non-Ferguson police officers outside of the Ferguson Police Department, because it is true that they are trying to link it to protesters. They're saying that the suspect took part in protest, in more than one protest. So, I mean, just to say that, you know, well, that shows that these people are violent. They're, you know, animals. They're this, they're that, they're, you know what I'm saying? That is what we are seeing coming out of this. And the facts are questionable. We're not getting all the facts. We're getting conflicting information from the St. Louis prosecutor, from the St. Louis police chief, from who off the gate, you know, said that police were the target. Now we're hearing that they weren't the target. They were just innocent bystanders, you know. Wow. They found a way in Ferguson to turn two cops into innocent bystanders. But yeah. But then they say they don't, you know, the same person will turn around and say, and I'm speaking to Bob McCullough, in the same breath, turn around and say that, well, we're not ruling it out. That it's still possible. I mean, just so much conflicting information, but nobody is really talking about, except for those who pay attention to police terrorism and publish articles and whatnot about it. But a cop says killing black people is okay because it's not against the law to put an animal down. Police officers in San Francisco, California, are under investigation after they were caught exchanging racist texts. The text messages were exchanged between former Sergeant Ian Firminger and current officers, Michael Robinson, Noel Swab, Rain Doherty, and Michael Seelis, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. This revelation comes on the heels of the federal prosecution and conviction of Sergeant Firminger on corruption charges. Oh, so they do charge people in some places. So what's up with the U.S. attorney over the District of Ferguson? See, some people will say, well, it's Eric Holder and whatnot. But really, you know, certainly Eric Holder could be behind closed doors lobbying for this U.S. attorney over that district to, you know, prosecute these people under RICO Act violations. But if I'm not mistaken, you know, it's all in the hands of that particular office. But as we can see, somebody in the U.S. attorney office, which upholds and, you know, charges people for violating federal law, whoever's over that district that covers San Francisco, they press charges, at least one of the guys. So I'm saying it is not unusual to see cops and other corrupt government officials get arrested. And it is just out of the norm. It's just really out of the norm for that to not be occurring in St. Louis County. It's just very odd. So some of the things the officers were caught saying include the following list, which was compiled by Alternet from a federal document made public last Friday. We got two blacks at my boy's school, and they are brother and sister. Their cause dad works for the school district, and I'm watching them like hawks. So here you got this cop watching black kids that go to school with his two boys. He's watching them like hawks. What is this? Why is he surveilling these children? In response to a text asking, do you celebrate Kwanzaa at your school? Fominga wrote, yeah, if we burn the cross on the field, then we celebrate whiteness. Something we heard from the fraternity where the racist suspects got suspended singing white supremacist songs. Sigma Alpha Epsilon, where they were having the Crypmas party. So now they celebrating whiteness. Yeah. You know, they're romanticizing about the crosses that they used to burn, like here in North Carolina, where, you know, this was a huge event. Grandma turned out, grandpa, sons, daughter-in-laws, children, grandchildren, just aunts, uncles. This was an event not that long ago in the area that I live in behind these enemy lines. So that's what he talking about. He talking about going to the football field, erecting a giant cross and having a, you know, Ku Klux Klan party. It's sick. Let me see. It's worth every penny to live here away from the savages. These are police officers. Those guys are pretty stupid. Ask some dumb ass questions you would expect from a black rookie. Sorry, they are your buddies. So look, that's some of the racism, white supremacy some black officers have complained about on the job. So, I mean, they just go on and on. There's no way I could read all of this to you. We are expected to speak to our guests here in just a few minutes. But again, now these are the slave catchers in the system that has never abolished slavery. These are people have been given badges, just like the slave patrols of old were given badges, given guns, and sworn in to uphold the system. And this is how they uphold it, in a racist manner. Racist practice and patterns is what they call it. But yet, you know, like the, what was it? The SPLC did the year in hate report that we talked about the other day. They said, you know, that a lot of this stuff, racism and stuff, you got these lone wolf types and they don't necessarily belong to a particular organization. But I would, say you need to reconsider that. You know, you're saying that these lone wolf racists who like to take to the internet and post all these racist comments, spreading hate, recruiting others, and say that, you know, they're not really in organizations and Stormfront's just a website and all of this and that. But aren't these police departments, organizations, having they filed papers, you know, that legally gives them standing as a organization, a corporation, and whatnot? These are organizations that are practicing racism, white supremacy, practicing hate, but yet they are not being named on this map or classified as a hate group by the SPLC, I believe, Southern Poverty Law Center. Again, this is not an anomaly. This goes on all across the world, but, you know, fortunately, I don't know the details of how this got exposed, but however it got exposed, somebody came across this and said, you know what? I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to participate by acting like I just didn't see all of this racist stuff come through here. And I'm the one that has to check, you know, the log for the text messages. And they want to call people dumb. They using their cell phones, work phones to text racist stuff in, but they want to call people ignorant and stupid and whatnot. But yeah, you come across this information and you say, no, I'm going to have to make a copy of this. Number one, take it home. And then number two, bring it to people's attention. bring it to people's attention, take it up with the boss and ask him questions. Is this correct for these deputies to be, you know, holding a position of police officer and to be saying these sort of things about the people they are supposed to be protecting, but they're not protecting them. They're not. They are operating in the context of the 13th Amendment. Legalized slavery, and you can't have slavery without victims. You can't do it. It just doesn't work that way. So this is pretty sad. But I don't think it's getting the attention. And this was published on countercurrentnews.com. Just came out today. So check that out if you have an opportunity. I do believe we are joined by our scheduled guest, Ms. Angela Chan. Do we have you on the line, ma'am?
Yes. Hi there. Is this Scotty Reed?
Yes, ma'am, it is. Welcome to our live broadcast of Black Talk Radio News. We're so glad that you could share a portion of your afternoon talking to us about important issues. And I've been talking about you and the work that you and your co-authors did in putting out this article. I've been talking about it during the entire broadcast, and it is dead on. I just want to say that, you know, right off the gate. And ask you some questions, but I just want to express to you, just as a person who considers himself an abolitionist, to thank you, you know, for this work and getting this out to the masses.
Thank you very, very much. I actually listened to your prior broadcast where you discussed this piece, and I so appreciate the thoughtful dialogue and all the great work that you and your co-hosts have done for over the years.
You're welcome. Well, hey, if somebody's got to do the work, somebody has to do the work. So, you've done the work in this case, and unlike, me, you actually have a law degree. This is your profession. And so, you know, when someone like you, and we've had others, law professors and others who have talked about this issue, and they've said the same thing. And that just seems, you know, you would think that carries a little bit more weight, a little bit credibility. So that leads me to my first question is, have any all other than alternative media outlets such as, you know, Black Talk Radio Network, has anyone, any of the corporate news programs reached out to you to interview you about your article?
That's a great question. No, actually, there's a lot, as you mentioned on the previous radio show, we've gotten a lot of Facebook shares and lots of tweets. It's been really impressive, the amount of interest this article has generated. But I haven't gotten a request for an interview specifically about this piece. I certainly do lots of interviews on all the issues that I work on, including immigrant rights issues and criminal justice issues, but not on this specific piece.
And this piece came out, what, March 2nd was when it's posted?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it came out March 2nd, so just a couple weeks ago. And it was written in collaboration with two other attorneys at my organization, Anoop Prasad, who is a senior immigration attorney, and Winnie Kao, who is a senior litigation and employment attorney. And the idea, and I work and I manage our criminal justice reform program at Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus, which is a nonprofit civil rights organization based in San Francisco. We've been around for about 40 years. I've been at my organization for almost 9 years, 8.5 years. And we decided to write this piece because we saw the overlap between the criminal justice work that I do, immigration, and also workers' rights. As you can see from the piece, the problem with the continuation of really slavery in the United States is that it cuts across all three areas, and it particularly, of course, impacts the Black community the most, but the Asian and Latino community also have been impacted by this mass incarceration crisis that we've had for a long time.
Right. So to answer the question, no, I'm just kind of, you know, I don't want to use the word shocked by it, but I just want to, you know, just point out to my listeners that I feel like, you know, you got a headline like this coming out of the Huffington Post, and it's just getting straight to the point, and it's telling you that slavery is codified in the United States Constitution, and I mean, you would think after 150 years that, you know, this would be headline news around the globe. And I just find it odd that not even a single one that people consider as mainstream media has invited you or your attorney co-authors on this report, because it's really basically what it is. It's more than an article. I feel like it's a legal analysis and report on the 13th Amendment. So I just find that odd, Ms. Chan.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your invite. I think it's folks like you at Black Talk Radio that really start the conversation and are ahead of the curve, way ahead of the curve, and everyone else will eventually catch up, especially in mainstream media. But it looks like just the people out there in the world, in the community, they're interested. I mean, I'm looking at the stats now, and there's 29,000 likes on Facebook and 8,600 shares on Facebook and 475 tweets. So, I mean, it looks like that is resonating with the readers of Huffington Post, and it's been shared widely. And I think having me on in this radio show to talk about this piece also contributes to that dialogue.
I will say it is encouraging. It's very encouraging to see, you know, outlets such as the Huffington Post to, you know, publish such a piece. Now, when did you all, and I'm talking about your co-authors as well, when did you all, well, I guess I have to put this to you individually because they're not here to answer for themselves, but when did you come to the realization that slavery was not abolished in 1865? As I'm sure, I don't know your background, if you grew up in the United States, attended, you know, whatever school system in the United States, but it's pretty much universally taught that slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment in 1865. So here we are in 2015, and you're part of this report that says that is not in fact true. So when did you first come to this realization?
Yeah, and what you're describing is exactly what I experienced. And I was born and raised in the United States, in actually Portland, Oregon. And that is what I was taught in school, that slavery ended a long time ago, and that we're in a different phase now, especially post-civil rights movement in the 1960s. So that is certainly what I was taught in school. It wasn't until I started working on criminal justice issues in law school, and then continued that work at the Asian Law Caucus, Advancing Justice, Asian Law Caucus, where I work, over the last 8.5-9 years. That I realized that what I was taught in school is not true, and that there are many people who are detained in both our immigration and our criminal justice system who are basically treated as slaves. The conditions in the jail system are horrendous. The fact that they are separated from their family members is terrible. And then what happens post incarceration in terms of the inability to vote in many cases, to get a job, to get housing, to get health care, all of that I consider completely really unexplainable. I don't think it works if we really need to create a just society and a society where everyone is free. So that I've kind of come to this realization through this work, through working directly with people who are incarcerated. I think people who don't get a chance to do that probably aren't as exposed to and don't get to see this realization firsthand. My colleagues, especially Anup Prasad, who works in the immigration detention facilities, I believe for about a decade now, I think that he's also come to the same realization through working directly with people who are detained in the immigration prisons, realizing the way in which they're treated, the lack of rights they're given, and just overall the dehumanization of people who are locked away and considered often invisible to the rest of society.
So how, once you came to this realization, how did it impact you on either a personal level, spiritually, emotionally, professionally, and which we could see, you know, by you all putting out this report, how, you know, that has impacted you professionally because you're writing about it. So, but how did it impact you on a personal level or emotionally?
Sure. Yeah. Great question. And I should say, when I first started out at Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus, I worked in a very narrow area of criminal justice. I was focused on helping parents who are immigrants who have children in the juvenile system who have a difficulty navigating the juvenile system because of language and cultural barriers. Let's say they're not giving an interpreter in court, they can't talk to the probation officer, their own lawyers. So it is a specific kind of narrow way I entered this area. And as I was working with the children who were in the juvenile system and realizing the much bigger problem beyond language activism and cultural competency, that it's a problem in the first place, that they're arrested and detained and might really have less of a future because of being incarcerated, that's when I realized this is much bigger than I originally realized, and that that means the solution is a lot bigger than I originally realized. The solution isn't just providing language access. Obviously, that should happen. And it's not just providing cultural competency and making our system a little more easier to navigate. That's also challenging the system itself and asking why in the first place should kids be arrested? Why in the first place should a 13, 14-year-old be locked away and separated from their family in order to, quote-unquote, rehabilitate them when I know it does just the opposite? So I think the way it impacted me is it made me look, take a step back and look at the bigger picture and look, mm-hmm. and push me towards abolitionism, which is definitely the direction I'm in the more and more I work with people who are detained in our system.
Could you repeat that? Would you classify yourself as an abolitionist?
I would. I think there's not many of us, especially in the Asian American civil rights world, but I've come to this place, and I think I keep evolving it because it's a big question, right? Where yes. oftentimes when I present the idea of ending our prison system, the question I always get back is, well, then what do you do with the 2 million plus people who are locked away in our system? And I have lots and lots of developing answers, but I can't say I have all of them. That's why I say I'm moving in the direction of abolitionism, but I also consider myself an abolitionist. I just say I don't have all the answers. I think I learn as I go every day.
Now, I want to ask you a question, you know, professionally, because, again, you are an attorney, and the others who work with you on this report are attorneys as well. Again, you are the policy director and senior staff attorney at the Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. And so as a lawyer and looking at the 13th Amendment as a matter of law, doesn't it technically state that slavery, you know, is permissible under certain conditions?
That's right, and I printed out the text of the 13th Amendment in the HuffPost piece, and I should read it just for your listeners.
Sure.
Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, and then here's the big except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So if we were to break this exception down, which is a huge exception, and we've seen through time how large this exception is to justify the 2 million plus people who are detained on average in the United States, one-fourth of the world's prison population, that punishment for crime is very broad. Who determines what is a crime? And we've seen through the last couple of decades, it's often states that determine what a crime is, the state legislature or voters of a state. And what they determine to be a crime is often very political. It might be, I think the most common example of how a crime is made in our statutes is a bad thing will happen and a politician will use that bad thing as an excuse to fearmonger and get the rest of the population to make something a crime. And then that crime will be disproportionately used to arrest and imprison, especially people of color, especially people in the Black community. And so that's why you have crimes that are there. I mean, all of this is really socially constructed, and you have crimes anywhere from vagrancy to public drunkenness, a lot of crimes just of being poor that we have in this country as a result of the way in which our crimes are made. And as you pointed out in your previous discussion last week, this isn't a new thing. I'm pointing out the last 20, 30 years because that's when our prison system especially bloomed. That's where we definitely made these giant, giant mega prisons. But as you guys pointed out, that this exception, except as a punishment for crime where the party shall have been duly convicted, in the 13th Amendment has been used really right after the passage of the 13th Amendment. Kind of reviewing the history again and saw exactly what you were talking about, that as soon as the 13th Amendment was passed, within a year or two, you have the Black Codes, which are the laws passed by various states in order to criminalize basically any behavior they can find in order as an excuse to arrest and incarcerate and use the labor of Black people, especially newly freed Black people. So it's been a long history of this, and a long history of this exception being used.
I want to revisit something you mentioned, because, you know, I think it is important to point out to people, we're not talking about primarily just black men, although they are the most victimized and the most targeted. This happens to all non-white people, and then white people based on their economic classification. But it also happens to children, like you were speaking of earlier, you know. One of the co-hosts, Max Parthas of on New Abolitionist Radio, he has been, you know, repeating this statistic or dollar amount that he found in researching. Well, how much does it cost to incarcerate a child in the state of New York? And it was upwards of $250,000 a year per child. And so there's that profit motive. And I'm sure you're aware of the Kids for Cash scheme. And there's a video of the same name of these judges who were, quote unquote, selling these children, getting kickbacks under the table. And so, you know, why do we lock up children? Why do we do this and do that? Because of the slave trade. It's all about making money, making a profit. And this is one of the ways using the loophole of the 13th Amendment that they can revenue streams, which is, you know, a very important storyline in the Department of Justice report out of Ferguson. Your thoughts?
That's exactly my analysis also. I think when I started working in the juvenile system and working with children, well, first of all, I was shocked going inside a juvenile hall, seeing kids that looked just very, very young, anywhere from 12, 13 years old, and up, sometimes even younger than that, in shackles, in jumpsuits, in orange jumpsuits, being paraded through the juvenile facility, and just thinking, there's no way this is the best course of action to deal with whatever this youth is accused of doing. There's no way this is good for their future. And how can we, as a modern society, as a society that prides itself on being advanced and being first world and being the best, you know, country in the world, how could we possibly do this to our kids? So that piece was shocking to me. And since then, I've gotten used to it, unfortunately, by being in the juvenile system, but it is completely shocking. Where juvenile hall is located, they probably don't believe that that the people locked up in the facility are overwhelmingly minority. Even in San Francisco, that's really a pretty white and Asian town. The vast majority of people in our juvenile system are Asian, Black, and Latino. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it, the school to prison pipeline, or the larger mass incarceration, the school systems feed into this through their disciplinary measures, where they basically can punish kids for being quote unquote defiant or not listening to teachers and not conforming to what the teachers might want, teachers that are only minorities. And that rather than trying to address the issue or try to provide cultural competence training and diverse teachers, they push these kids out of the school system and move them into the juvenile system, therefore depriving them of the future. And so kind of pulling back even further, that led me to work in the school system and to challenge when a kid is suspended or expelled to say, hey, let's not look at just the behavior of this kid. Let's look at what the school did when this stuff first started happening. And did the school wash their hands of this, waited for it to escalate, and then use this as an excuse to pull into the gym? Analysis really helps look at the deeper of systemic causes for why we have such a ballooning mass incarceration system that really impacts primarily the Black community, but certainly the Latino and Asian communities also.
Now, one of the things that appears, I should say, one of the issues brought out in this article that, you know, you produce with your co-authors, it says, I'm going to just quote it. Although the prison industrial complex was seemingly designed for the wholesale incarceration of Black communities, Asian, Pacific Islanders, and other non-Black people of color are trapped in the same system. Southeast Asians, Pacific Islanders, and Latinos are all incarcerated at disproportionate rates. However, we cannot achieve liberation until we address anti-Black racism in our own communities and build connections between our struggles, those of African Americans, in slavery. Now, my question to you is, did you author that portion? And if you did not, do you agree with it? And can you provide us some scenarios of anti-Black racism in other non-white communities?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for highlighting this paragraph. This is a paragraph that Anup Prasad and Winnie Cal, myself, we all share this analysis. So I could say we all co-authored this. We all agree. Anup Prasad definitely took the lead in writing this piece, which I'm grateful for. But I certainly agree and share this analysis. So in terms of this piece here, kind of a couple things to point out. The prison industrial complex was designed primarily to incarcerate Black communities because of the historical connection that I described, the move from slavery to the 13th Amendment to this exception, which basically continued slavery. And that we know our prison system was unfortunately designed to do. But as a byproduct, Asians and Latinos have also been trapped in the system. There's a number of reasons why. I think because of the way our communities are racially segregated, where you do have Blacks, Asians, and Latinos living in poor communities together, separated from wealthier white communities, and you have policing overwhelmingly throughout the country that targets minority communities, especially Black communities. I think Asians and Latinos are often a byproduct of this over-policing and over-criminalization of Black communities. And so that's why, for example, Southeast Asians, which groups often live in Black communities after coming as refugees to this country, they're often also over-criminalized and over-arrested and are disproportionately locked up in the system compared to their populations in the U.S. That is our analysis of how that has happened. The target is the Black community, but as a byproduct, because of the proximity of the Asian Latino community to the Black community, you also have these different groups locked up. And you also have a system that uses the labor of all three of these groups in order to make money. The corporations that make money off of their labor in the prison system are more than happy to put more community bars in order to make that money. In terms of the focus on anti-Black racism, I think that's something that all three of us have talked about for some time, because you can't go into this work, the civil rights work, and say, I'm here to help only Asians. I'm here to help only my community. Or if you're Latino, I'm here to only help Latinos. Because if you don't realize and don't recognize and accept and challenge the fact that the prison system and many of our other unjust systems, such as our policing system, such as our school systems, were designed primarily to oppress Black communities, then you're never going to solve also the impact on Asian and Latino communities. And so that is something that we've been pushing and explaining for quite some time. And I think it's also much more powerful when you are not from a community, but you struggle with that community and fight for that community as if it's your own. I think it's harder to dismiss you as saying, oh, you're only doing this because you happen to be born Asian. That's why you're helping Asians. I mean, if you go into Black communities or Latino communities and genuinely want to work with these communities to challenge the bigger system that impacts all of you, I think it's a much more powerful statement, and the impact is much bigger.
Mm-hmm. Let me restate one of the portions of, because anti-Black racism, I've heard it described, and I may even agree with, you know, that media plays, well, I certainly subscribe to and promote that media is a tool, is a vehicle, if you will, to where you have a racist virus that is transmitted, you know, to the minds of different people. And so I guess the question I was, you know, really looking to have answered is, you know, is there any kind of Black, anti-Black racism that you feel that exists that is based on stereotypes about the Black community, which we know is primarily promoted by American news media? And so if you do believe that is one of the ways that they spread this anti-Black racism, I mean, how do we solve that? What do you tell people who might be victimized by this propaganda media to hate or dislike or not care for, you know, this other community?
Sure, and thank you for this question. I think it hits at the heart of what we are struggling with at the Asian Law Caucus as we fight civil rights issues. One of the things we try to challenge, the stereotype of Asians as a model minority, that Asians are, you know, successful and more educated and make more money and that are a successful minority group. And part of the reason why we challenge that stereotype is because it's a racist, anti-Black stereotype. if Asians are the model minority, then who is the unmodel minority? And the implication is the unmodel minority are African Americans who have, you know, quote unquote, been here longer, if you want to simplify, accessible as newer immigrants such as Asians or newer arrivals such as Asians. And we challenge that. One is because it's not true. There are a lot of Asians who are poor, particularly in the Southeast Asian and Pacific Islander communities who are struggling. And two, we should not be allow ourselves to be used and to be used to really to oppress other communities and to push down other communities. And so there's a really great piece by a professor named Mari Matsuda called We Will Not Be Used. And it was actually a piece that she spoke about at our Asian Law Caucus banquet that we have annually. She gave this speech, I believe, about 20 years ago. And that speech still resonates with me because it's the call to say that Asians shouldn't be used. We shouldn't try to think that we're better than another group because really, you know, one, we're not. And two, that oppresses other communities and we should not allow ourselves to be used in that respect. I mean, that same argument, I think, applies for affirmative action based also in a debate where some Asian groups or Asian members of the community might think, well, I'm innocent. This person is guilty, so therefore they belong in the prison system. And the implication is, you know, well, how do you, you know, why do you think you're innocent? And why do you think the other party is guilty? And is it a matter of race? And so hopefully that answers some of what you're asking, but that's a part of us challenging anti-Black racism through our work.
Yes, that was sufficient. One last question, cause I know we have had you up, you know, for about 30 minutes scheduled. So, one last question that I would like to ask is the article also brought up. Now, let me preface this question, with this statement. I think that, you know, it has been established, that slavery is legal in the United States and is being practiced by state actors, federal government, along with private corporations. That is happening. And it's legal because it's codified as punishment for crime. Slavery is permissible. That's what the United States Constitution says. The U.S. Constitution is supposed to be the supreme law of the land. So if I'm going by what the supreme law says, then slavery is being practiced. I can't go bring these people up on criminal charges for practicing slavery because it's allowed in this context of the 13th Amendment. But in your article, it is brought out that this practice, while legal against those who are classified as U.S. citizens, certainly maybe not treated as U.S. citizens, but it's legal to practice slavery against them, but it's illegal and not permissible under the 13th Amendment to use immigrant, you know, detainees as slave labor. Did I read that correctly? Did I interpret that correctly? And can you expound upon that?
Sure. So there's a couple issues. There are about 33,000 to 34,000 immigrants detained in our immigration prisons throughout the country, and on any given day, about 400,000 immigrants detained in our immigration prisons annually. So it's a lot of people, and it's a growing population that the prison industrial complex is profiting off of and making a lot of money building new facilities for, or new prisons for. And it's for many of these people, what they're considered violating is civil immigration law. Being actually in this country without paperwork is a civil law violation and not a criminal law violation, according to our federal system. Mm-hmm. So that does appear to violate even this exception in the 13th Amendment that focuses on crime. However, the federal government has sometimes tried to get around this by saying, well, if you've been deported before and you come back again, and often people do come back to be with their children, to be with their family members, to survive, then they are charged as a criminal matter for illegal reentry, which is considered a federal crime, and then they could fall into the exception of the 13th Amendment. And so that kind of goes into what I described earlier, the way in which our criminal statutes are really socially constructed and constructed in a way to put away people of color.
Mm-hmm. So the initial person who comes here and doesn't have any papers and the system, you know, calls it, you're here illegally, and this is a civil penalty, so therefore these people, if they're being detained on their initial capture and then they're being put to work. And would you say that's the majority that makes up the majority? You say is growing. I can certainly, you know, co-sign to that, that, you know, the GEO group is expanding and on their earnings calls have talked a lot about, detaining immigrants and new facilities for that. But these people are being put to work. Right. I mean, they are making a profit for, I mean, we just saw a big uprising down in Willacy, County, Texas, where this was described as an immigration detention facility and they had a work stoppage.
That's right. The vast majority of people for detainer and immigration prisons are people who are there for violating civil immigration law. So this is an example of the way in which this exception to the 13th Amendment is really not even being applied correctly. It's being expanded as beyond really the words of this exception. Mm-hmm. And I think mainstream media and just kind of your average everyday person doesn't see that. They think, well, you're here illegally, so therefore it must be a crime. Therefore you must be illegal, quote unquote. And of course we take the stance that no human being is illegal. Mm-hmm. But we also take the stance that, well, the federal government has categorized this as a civil violation, so that is not a justification. However, at the Asian Law Caucus, we push back on that. We're not saying that we are only fighting for immigrants who are categorized as violating the civil immigration laws. We're pushing for freedom for everybody, because we, from working in our immigration and criminal justice system, we know that it is not right, no matter what kind of legal maneuvers you use, to put someone away and use their labor in order to capitalize for various corporations and prison industrial complex companies such as CCA and GEO Group.
Right, right. Well, we've come to the conclusion. I did check the phone lines. Lots of people listening, but nobody has any questions, because I guess you just made it so plain and clear. They don't have any questions. You have answered them all already. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing? How can people follow your work? You know, how can we build on these alliances that you say, you know, need to happen with people identifying? Oh, looks like we got a caller. So let me get this caller.
Oh, great.
Can we take this last caller before you go?
That'd be wonderful.
Okay. Area code 803, you are on with Miss Angela Chan. Do you have a question or comment for her?
Greetings, Scotty. Greeting, Ms. Chan. This is Max Parthas from New Abolitionist Radio here on the Black Talk Radio Network. Sorry, Scotty, I thought I pressed the one earlier, and I was listening intently. I do have a question for you, if you have a moment. Well, when Scotty asked you about whether you consider yourself an abolitionist, at one point you said you kind of lean in towards the abolitionist views. I'm not so sure you understand what the views of the abolitionists of today really are at this point, because as you yourself stated, you're kind of just coming into this feeling and this awareness over the past few years of what exactly is occurring. Our goals in the abolitionist movement are very simple, and they're very reasonable. One, I think we can all agree that private prisons need to be abolished. There should be no prison for profit, period, right? And that's one of the things that we're aiming for. The second thing is to remove the language that allows for slavery, not only in the federal constitution, but we've studied every single state constitution and come to the conclusion that many formerly free states actually incorporated this language in order to exploit the prison system over the years. So that should be taken out of all state and federal constitutions. And the other thing that you mentioned was a question I hear very often to people who are new to the awareness of what's going on and have yet to step over the boundary to they're doing this on purpose and it's slavery and they know it. And one of those things is, what will we do with these 2.5 million people? We just can't let them go into communities. Well, 1.6 million of those people are in there for nonviolent drug-related or traffic-related or fine-related charges. Those people don't deserve to be in there. They shouldn't be in there. And even to question what we should do with them is a confusing thing to say to begin with. Let them go. It's really just that simple. The money that we would save based on incarcerating these people can be reinvested into rebuilding the communities, helping create small businesses and jobs and people to buy homes. You could rebuild America literally just with that money alone. So
my question to you,
have I said anything that you would disagree with?
Not at all, actually. I appreciate your these points and pointing out the goals of abolitionism. I agree with all of them wholeheartedly. And actually to your point three about this kind of often reaction that people have about what to do with the 2 million. What we've done at the Asian Law Caucus is that we've said, let's never use prison and punitive measures as a solution to a problem that we encounter. And that is how we can move towards a world where we don't use prisons and we don't use removing someone away from their community as a quote-unquote solution to a whole variety of problems where this is not the solution. It's, in fact, it's more harmful. And that practice is, I have to say, it's a challenging one because the rest of our world is not there yet, but it is something that we're committed to doing. So, for example, working on hate crimes work, where someone is accused to have harmed someone else based on their race, gender, et cetera. Even in that context where it is quite easy to say, well, let's just put that person away, we try very hard to not ask for that, instead to ask for alternatives, because we realize that putting someone in the prison system actually exacerbates racial tensions. There's lots of racial gangs, for example, in our prison system, and that doesn't address the cause of the original incident that happened. And so I agree with you on all three points, and I guess that makes me not just moving towards abolitionism, but an abolitionist. But I have to say, the reason I didn't embrace it so quickly is I want to recognize that there are many, many people who've worked on this area for much, much longer than I have, and I want to respect the people who've done that, and not to try to co-op or take any of that space away.
I appreciate that, and welcome to the club.
Thanks very much.
To so many people, and to rebuild our communities and our country. And one day, maybe we can live up to the dream of America, but it has to start with us stopping the hypocrisy and calling ourselves the land of the free. When we have the largest prison population in the history of the entire world, never before anywhere has there been so many cages built specifically for humans. And just last year, 24 million people went through our jails and prisons and systems that oversee those prisoners. That's 24 million people, and every single one of them generated a profit. Scotty mentioned a quote earlier about how much it costs to incarcerate the kids, and it's actually more than he even said. He said $250,000 a year in New York. It's $352,000 a year in New York. And if that isn't evidence of people doing this for profit, then I don't know what is.
Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you for your comments. I so appreciate them.
I appreciate your good work. Thank you so much, and keep up the great work. Keep this out there in the system so others can continue to talk about it. The more it is observed, the clearer it becomes what we face. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for laying the groundwork for pieces like this.
Oh, wait a minute, though, Miss Chan, before we let you go, because this question has been put to me as well by people who have reached out to me, and we who consider ourselves abolitionists, we didn't start anything. This has been going on for 400 years. We suspect there has been an abolitionist movement since, you know, slavery started being practiced on this continent, and they just haven't been recognized by the mainstream media, or, you know, it's just not mainstream. But there are probably hundreds of thousands of unknown individuals throughout history who would consider themselves abolitionists and did in some way fight to, you know, end slavery in this country. And like I told somebody else, it's just as simple as telling people that the 13th Amendment, telling people the truth, which the title of your article is that simple. Just telling somebody that slavery was never abolished in the United States, we hope, we'll send them down that road of further investigation that they do themselves, and then they too become abolitionists. To be an abolitionist, all you got to do is believe slavery is wrong and do whatever you can in whatever capacity to end it. It's that simple for me.
Thank you. That's a great and clear way of putting it. I think that that's wonderful. I'll actually make use of that if you don't mind.
Most certainly. Feel free. Well, I want to thank you again. Is there anything that you wanted to tell listeners to, you know, Facebook pages? How can they keep up with the work of your organization and follow, you know, any future writings from you?
Sure. Thanks very much for that opportunity. So if you just go to advancingjustice.org, that should be our website, and you will see the Asian Law Caucus there at the top. And then you can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And we do try very, very hard to push out this message the best we can. So it'd be great if people could retweet us to like us. And also just feedback that I've received, for example, from your co-host, from Max, is really, really useful. And so we love that type of dialogue. And so please keep it going. I noticed that Black Talk Radio tweeted at me, and I appreciate that. And the more we can just keep this going out there in the ether so that people are really forced to think about these really hard questions and to come to where we are, where you are, on abolitionism, I think that would be amazing. So thanks very much for having me on the show, and I'd love to be back whenever there's a chance.
Most certainly. You have a great afternoon, Ms. Chan, and we will stay in touch and continue to follow your great work.
Thank you, Mr. Scotty Reed. Appreciate it.
Goodbye. Okay, so that concludes our interview with Ms. Chan. We certainly appreciate her dropping by. I am going to take a short break, and let me pull up today's program. The phone lines are going to stay open. If anybody has any afterthoughts on our interview and conversation with Ms. Chan, you're certainly welcome to share those. Max, your line is open, but we are going to take a short break. And please don't wait to the last minute to call in and ask the questions, because there is another program coming up right at, we hope, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, if I can get them on air on time. So we want to wrap up on time here with Black Talk Radio News. So that phone number is 530-881-1400. The access code is 549032#. Hit *6 and 1. And we will get your comments on air. So we have, what, about 15 minutes, we'll say, 15 minutes left in the program, and you can get those in. But stay with us. We're going to take a short break and come back and discuss the rest of the news. Thoughts about Ms. Chan? I don't think I have time, but I will discuss the Ferguson Police Department issuing all of these contradictory reports and statements. And then I got a clip I'm gonna play. I played it last week, but a clip of this, it sounds like, and it sounds like, you know, that this person is a white male. I can't say that for a fact, but, you know, from his voice pattern and whatnot and his phonetics, he kind of sounded like a white male. And the comments he made right after the shots were heard, which allegedly struck two police officers in Ferguson that don't work for Ferguson Police Department out there moonlighting, I guess. But yeah, the comments that this white male has made, those are the comments that's being attributed to Michael Brown's mother, Miss Leslie McFadden. And I'm like, man, am I the only one that's seeing the connection here? They just flipped what this white male said about police. If they had not, if they'd have done the right thing 6 months ago, this wouldn't have happened. A white male said that, not Michael Brown's mother. She did not do that. She had issued a press release right when it happened, saying how they condemned the violence and whatnot. And why are they even going to her? You know, Miss McFadden's a victim here. She don't speak for every victim on the planet. Okay, so, I mean, why are they even going to her and saying, you know, expecting her to come out and condemn, you know, this or that which allegedly occurred? I mean, come on, man. Let's think about these things logically. So yeah, let's take this break and then we'll come back and put those things out there before we wrap it up.
See, Lyndon Johnson, he can always raise an argument about law and order because he never talks about justice. But black people fall for that same argument, and they go around talking about lawbreakers. We did not make the laws in this country. We are neither morally nor legally confined to those laws. Those laws that keep them up keep us down. You got to begin to understand that. For 400 years, she taught you white nationalism and you lapped it up. You taught it to your children. You had your children thinking that everything black was bad. Black cows don't give good milk. Black hens don't lay eggs. Black for funerals, white for weddings. That's white nationalism. Santa Claus. A white honky who slides down a black chimney and comes out white. We can equate progress with concessions. We can no longer make that mistake. You see, when they gave us that nigger astronaut, you said we were making progress, but I told you they were going to lose him in space. He didn't get that far. You put Adam Clayton Powell in office and you couldn't keep him. What you think they're going to do with Thurgood Marshall when they get tired of him? They gave you Walter Washington of Washington, D.C., and you said we were making progress. That's not progress. See, it's no in-between. You're either free or you're a slave. There's no such thing as second-class citizenship. That's like telling me you can be a little bit pregnant.
Host of the Abolitionist Daily and co-host of New Abolitionist Radio. What I first loved about the Black Talk Radio Network was how the programming was giving a voice to my passion. I love that the broadcasts were able to teach me ways that I could help build a community that I want to be a part of. Now, just a few years later, and the Black Talk Radio Network features my voice, and I understand how valuable it is in changing lives. Malcolm X warned us to take the power of the media seriously. It was Malcolm who said, "The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent." He wasn't lying, and we know that it takes a strong and consistent media force to compete with the negative images and messages of misinformation which flow throughout the mainstream day and night. Well, the Black Talk Radio Network is that strong and consistent media force, offering a wide range of programming with topics from politics to faith, from health to Pan-Africanism, Black history, and the latest headlines are on Black Talk Radio News. 24 hours every day, 7 days a week, live streaming and downloadable podcasts, all through a platform that is compatible with major outlets like TuneIn, iTunes, and stream seamlessly through mobile devices and even in your car. We do all we can to fulfill our end, researching, studying topics in depth so we can give informed commentary, inviting guests who are leaders in their professional and academic fields so we can hear from the experts. And when it comes to the grassroots, no one makes more connections and establishes relationships with the folks who are in the streets and at the meetings, the people who are actively protesting, agitating for a better world, and activating minds to join the struggle. In all of this, though, we need your help to make sure the message continues to go out all across this nation and across the world. The Black Talk Radio Network is listened to by tens of thousands of faithful listeners and adding new listeners every day. We need your help to continue the mission and grow the network. Come to the website blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and click on the link to donate. Let's make sure we keep this new media going forward and as we go forward.
To Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, of course, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network. Just some of the programming that is coming up following Black Talk Radio News at 6 o'clock. The Thando Radio program will be on air, I believe, Brother Dave, and the Thando Radio Show family. Man, I got tongue-tied. Y'all excuse me. The Thando Radio family, they will be discussing banking and asking the question and looking at the evidence to see is there a banking crisis looming in the United States. And if so, you know, what is that going to mean for everyday folks? And are there things that people can do now to prepare for that? So make sure you check that out. That program, again, that is Thando Radio Show. And the weekly hour-long program, Let's Build with Doshan Farad, will be on air tonight, and they are going to be discussing the Ferguson Department of Justice report, as well as reports about war with Iran. Brother Doshan will be speaking with the founder of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, former New Jersey Police Sergeant DeLacy Davis, and New Black Panther Party St. Louis Chapter Chairwoman Dacia Polk. And they're going to talk about the Department of Justice report on Ferguson and police racial profiling there and across the nation. And then on segment two, they will be speaking with Marjorie Romaine Sanabria, I believe that's how you pronounce her name, and Democratic strategist Roy Paul on the Iran controversy. Are Republicans trying to push the U.S. into another very costly war? So that's 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. That comes on every Monday night. That is Let's Build with Doshan Farad. So that's just some of the live programming that's coming up. Let me see. Go to the phone lines. Max, did you have anything else that you wanted to share as before we get ready to wrap it up here on the Black Talk Radio Network? I certainly was impressed by the, you know, just the forthrightness of Mrs. Chan. I mean, Mrs. Chan just straight up, yup, slavery is happening. Oh, I'm sorry, Max. I'm sorry. Man, this happens during the program sometimes. You were muted. Please go ahead.
Yes, it's things like that that give me hope, Scotty, because really the only way we're going to get any change in this country, and we've seen how that works, is by forcing the conversation into mainstream media, and it places these slavers' backs against the walls where they have to respond to these charges. And as long as we've got them on the defensive, it means that we're moving towards freedom, you know? So that gives me hope when I hear, whether it be mainstream or semi-mainstream, put any message like this out. And I really appreciate the fact that we have a Black Talk Radio Network as a platform for people to come in and speak like this, because you know they're not going to allow them to talk like this on MSNBC, CNN, or Fox. It's just not, they're not ready for that yet. But there will come a time soon, I believe, we won't have much of a choice.
Yeah, I mean, did you agree with my assessment that, you know, it's pretty extraordinary that someone, not just anyone, but a group of lawyers can come together and write this article titled Slavery Never Abolished in America. What I want to make sure people had the right title, and I have linked to the article. I got to get back to that page, but yeah, I have linked to the article.
I read your analysis. It was awesome, Scotty. I shared that around as well, the one you wrote on the 13th Amendment, and I think you referred to her article in there.
The article on hiding slavery, you know, yeah, as the most successful mass media, yep, marketing program in the history of mass media, in the history of man. Academic fraud widespread, because this is being taught on all the universities and have been since the 1800s, you know, that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery and it did no such things. Great, you know, these supposed to be the great minds and whatnot, and they're putting it, and I feel like that was deliberate. So,
you know, I would suggest that you send in that to the HuffPost, the same area where she had hers published, and also to the Black Agenda Report to get that out there. I think it needs a lot more displaying than it's getting right now. So that's a great way to show people how it works. So we do have ends in these places. Let's use them.
Right. America never abolished slavery. So my question to her was, have any of these places, MSNBC, Politics Nation, I think that's the name of Mr. Al Sharpton's program, Radio One or TV One, Roland Martin. I know somebody that's a regular on Roland Martin's show. I'm going to see if they will have Miss Chan on, but nobody, she said nobody's reached out to her. from these mainstream organizations. And so, yeah, let's push it. Let's put people on the spot because they on Twitter and whatnot. And I've actually had Politics Nation, their producers, you know, reply back to me on Twitter. And how come y'all haven't had Miss Chan or any of the other co-authors of this piece published on the Huffington Post to discuss the fact that America never abolished slavery and how that is manifested in the way, you know, the prison industrial complex operates today. So I don't know, Max, do we attempt to, you know, launch a propaganda war demanding that she gets airtime on this great article?
Well, I don't know if I would say that she is the perfect representative to represent the abolitionist movement. She's kind of new into it herself. For her, like many others that I've seen over the years, this is coming, like, crashing down on her psyche. Like, well, you know, you have to come to a conclusion.
Yeah, Max.
Either they know what they're doing or they don't. You
well,
can't
Max,
just,
let
it go.
Let me just say this here. She will be going on to represent her work. They can ask her if she an abolitionist or not. She said on this show that she has to be, considering the criteria that was laid out. Then yes, she is. So it's not about anybody, in my opinion, being a spokesperson for the abolitionist movement. Cause the way I see it, we're pretty much leaderless. You know what I'm saying? We have sales operating all in individuals, lone wolves, even if you will, that consider themselves abolitionists. So,
I'm referring to when they start asking questions that come after the fact, like, what do we do about this? Like she herself said, what do we do with 2.45 million people?
She said, she said that they teach abolitionism. She said, close them. We don't need prisons to solve
the problem. Close them.
So I would certainly think that she's qualified with those beliefs and the information she put out to go on mainstream media. Since she's already has her foot in that door already through Huffington Post, I'll be more than happy to see her go on these networks.
I would too, because, you know, she's talking about the truth, and the truth will defend itself pretty much, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So, Max, we come to the end of the program. Did anything you want to get out to the people as we get ready to wrap it up? Of course, gotta tell them about, you know, the work that you're doing.
Yes, make sure you tune in this Wednesday to New Abolitionist Radio. We're going to have a guest on, Madison Page. She's one of the people who work with Big Blue Magazine. She was actually the first to publish the abolitionist goals in a major magazine, which was in Big Blue last year. And she's an abolitionist herself. She also helps with the organizing the democratic strategies across the United States and their campaigns. So I'm looking forward to having Madison Page as part of our show this Wednesday at 8 p.m. right here on the blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All right, Max, you have a good day, man.
Peace, brother.
Peace. All right, so we're going to get ready to wrap it up again. Tando Radio Show is coming up here shortly in about 4 or 5 minutes. And then tonight at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern, it is Les Beal with Doshan Farad. So make sure y'all stay locked in to Black Talk Radio Network. .com. Again, want to thank Sister Cece for arranging the interview with Mrs. Chan, and want to thank Mrs. Chan for spending part of her day to come on and talk about the serious issue of slavery, not slavery past, but slavery present in America today. And we will be back on air tomorrow. I believe we have Brother Sharif Hamid coming on to talk about issues related to the juvenile justice system. So y'all hang tight. Peace and blessings to all until tomorrow.